This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Edward Jones has gone under many aliases, but he got his nickname, Hacksaw, from the FBI. Jones is a convicted burglar who escaped from prison 14 times in 20 years. He spent some time on the FBI's 10 most wanted list. During his last years in prison, he turned to writing. His autobiography, Hacksaw, was published in 1988. 2 years later, he was released from prison. Now he's completed his third crime novel about a former convict turned amateur detective. It's called Stoneface. Jones' escape record lengthened his time in prison. He spent very little of his adult life on the outside.
My original charge, I was 17 years old. I was in Richmond, Virginia. And the charge at that time was grand larceny by possession, which is now called just simply possession of stolen goods. I had bought a stolen wedding ring for my childhood sweetheart. We were both 17, decided to run away and get married. And we did get married, and I didn't have a ring at the time to give her. And I was working at a place that made sinkers and fish hooks. And one of my coworkers had a little small diamond ring, and he sold it to me for $35. So a week later, she was in downtown Richmond and stopped in at a pawn shop because she wanted to see if it was a real diamond in there, I think. It was just a little small diamond. And they had it on their, what they call their hot sheet. And that night, a detective came by and talked to me about it. And I said, yes, I had given it to her. And I was arrested, charged with grand larceny by possession. I was given 10 years and 2 years suspended on a chain gang. That was it.
Were there any other crimes you were convicted of other than breaking out of prison?
Over the years?
Yeah.
Yes. I've never made any excuse. Well, I did at first make some excuses, but I've never pulled any punches about my culpability, as it were. I have committed crimes. At the time that I, not if you want to call them serious or non-serious, whatever, they were still crimes. I have committed probably about 3 burglaries, mostly for clothes and food when I was on the run. I did, in Las Vegas, committed a burglary to get some money to get out of town. And let's see, I conspired with a jeweler in Fort Lauderdale, Florida in 1976 to make it appear that he had been robbed. This was in order so that he could defraud his insurance company, which was Lloyd's of London.
Now, the first time that you broke out of prison was during your first 10-year sentence of hard labor. You were on a chain gang, right?
Mm-hmm, right.
Before the first time you broke out, someone else from your chain gang had attempted to escape, but he was shot by a guard.
Right.
Why didn't that discourage you from breaking out yourself?
Well, quite opposite from discouraging me, I think it encouraged me because the person who was shot happened to be a friend of mine. His name was Tugboat Adams. Tugboat Adams, and he was nicknamed Tugboat because of the fact that he was built like a tugboat and was primarily the bull of the camp. But he really wasn't a bad guy, except the guards were really scared of him. And one day out on the road, one particular guard was getting his goat and had been pretty well riding him the whole day, accusing him of dragging and slow work and all of this, that, and the other. And at lunchtime, Tugboat was really mad, and he was sitting on a stump eating his sandwich, and he asked to urinate. And when you do that, you just kind of stand up, walk a few paces away, and turn your back. And, of course, the guard let him, and Tug just made a break for the wood line. And as he did, he was wearing chains. He was wearing leg irons. And as he did, the leg irons caught on a little stob that was in the ground, a little piece of a bush that had been cut, and it tripped him. And just as he went down, the guard fired the first shot, and the first shot missed him. And Tugboat rolled over and sat up, and he looked at the guard, and the guard looked at him, and then he shot him. Basically, I think what this did is it just angered me more than anything else, and it kind of reinforced my belief of what was happening at that particular time in the state of Virginia and probably other states as well with these chain gangs. So it only encouraged me to just want to get out of there.
So how did you escape that first time?
The first time I was wearing a set of leg irons, and we were piling brush out on the road, and I had been given 30 days in the hole a short time before that. And the reason why was because I had had a fight with the dog boy, and this was after Tugboat had been killed, because the dog boy ended up with a pair of his tennis shoes. And I was put in the hole for it, and while I was in the hole, I rubbed through one of the links on my leg irons till it was just practically all the way through. It was only a sliver holding it. And packed the crevice with some soap and rubbed a little dirt on it. And when I went out on the road after I was back in the basement on the work crew, and I went out on the road, it was about the third day, I believe, that I was out. And when the guard had his back turned for a few seconds, I popped the chain and hit the wood line, which was about 20 yards away. And, of course, no one expected me to move that fast because I had leg irons on, and I didn't realize that the chain had been broken.
So this is one of those classic escapes where you spent days and days and days rubbing the chain against concrete to file it down.
About 3 weeks.
What do you think of as being your most ingenious escape?
I don't think any of them have been ingenious. They were more acts of desperation at the time. And a lot of times you feel like you have to make something happen. In other words, you sit around and you wait and you look and you hope that in this particular situation, in a prison environment I'm talking about, and you obviously want to be released, you hope for parole or you hope for good behavior or whatever. And when that doesn't come, you know, it's a tremendous letdown. So then you start thinking about other ways to get out. At least I did. And the driving force behind my escape was I just didn't want to be there. I didn't like either crowd. I didn't like the prisoners I was with, and I didn't like the guards who were keeping me. So it was a question of where I just have to get out of here.
But time and time again, you'd get recaptured and brought back. So it would seem to me it would start to feel futile after a while.
I was never a very good fugitive, especially at the beginning. It was kind of like on-the-job training. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know anything about obtaining false identification, et cetera, anything like that. And, you know, there are no schools to teach this stuff. So it was a process of trial and error, and mostly when I got out, I did try to find legitimate work, and I found a lot of legitimate work while I was on escape. But it just seemed like something always happened, and I don't call it fate, call it stupidity. Certain instances I could call it stupidity on my part, but it just seemed like something always happened, and I ended up right back in their clutches.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Edward Jones, and he escaped from prison 14 times. Now he's actually out of prison, and he's become a writer in the past few years. He has written several books, including an autobiography called Hacksaw. He's also just published his third crime novel, and it's called Stoneface. One of your breakouts that really relied on your abilities as a con man was the time that you convinced FBI agents that you were going to lead them to a secret stash of stolen jewels. And what you were really leading them to was a gun that you had buried, a gun that actually didn't work, but they didn't know that. So while they were looking for the jewels, you were unburying the gun and then held them up and escaped.
That's true, but actually it was the other way around. They convinced me to do that.
They convinced you to lead them to the jewels?
Uh-huh. Right. This wasn't anything that I had concocted originally or planned right from square one. I'd kind of like to take credit for that if it was that good. But what had happened was that I had been arrested for this purported jewel robbery in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, with a jeweler by the name of Joseph Sergani. He had accused me of robbing him of $1.2 million in jewelry. When they arrested me, the FBI, along with the prosecuting attorney's office, Broward County Prosecuting Attorney's Office, were convinced that I had been involved in a whole rash of jewel thefts in the South Florida area. And in fact, they even told the news media that I was probably the biggest jewel thief in Florida. And yet I had never even been accused of another jewel thief, much less been convicted of one jewel theft, I'm sorry. But every day they would come to my cell and try to convince me to tell them where all this jewelry was and the rest of the jewelry from the Joseph Sergani robbery, quote unquote, because Joseph Sergani had actually said that twice as much jewelry was missing than actually he had. So after about 5 days of this, I decided that maybe they would agreed to just take me out because they wanted to find some jewelry so bad. So I figured maybe if I agreed with them, went along with them, said, okay, I'll take you to where the stuff is, maybe I could get them back to Georgia where there was a gun. And there was the gun was off of a wooded, well, it was in a wooded area off of a secondary road outside of Atlanta. And I had thrown it in a junk pile. This was a gun that Joseph Sergani himself had given me when we conspired to do this robbery. And there were no bullets in it. The firing pin was broken. It could not have worked if you'd wanted it to, if it was a life or death situation. And consequently, that's exactly the reason why I threw it out there. It's useless. But I remembered this, and this wild idea in my head, I wondered if a couple of them would take me out and I could possibly lead them there and pull this gun on them. And lo and behold, that's basically what they did. But they had six officers, and I wasn't expecting six. But that's how that happened. It wasn't initiated by me, and I just took advantage of the situation.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Edward Jones, and he was in prison for many years, escaped 14 times, which made him famous or infamous, and now he's really out, and he's become a writer in the past few years. He's written several books, including the autobiography Hacksaw, and a series of crime novels. The new crime novel is called Stoneface. We'll talk more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Edward Jones is my guest, and he's written a new novel called Stoneface, a crime novel. You were released in 1990.
Uh-huh.
How did you actually manage to get released?
I was paroled. In fact, it was an interesting situation. While I was in prison these later years, I had made up my mind in 1980 I was not going to escape ever again. But at the same time, I realized that I had to do something. And since I couldn't channel my energies into escaping anymore, I tried to channel them into writing. I received a lot of support from people, encouragement and whatnot, and I really enjoyed it. But after I wrote Hacksaw and had just finished writing an epilogue to it, as a matter of fact, my cell was searched by a couple of correctional officers. They confiscated the entire manuscript and the epilogue, and I was later called into the warden's office and told that he was confiscating the epilogue. And when I asked why, he said that it was contrary to the orderly running and security of the institution because I had drastically criticized them, and which was true. I was also warned not to write another epilogue. I did write another epilogue, and I sent it to my attorney. My attorney consequently sent it on to my publisher. And it was printed, and I was placed in Marion solitary confinement for 2.5 years behind that, and was ordered not to write anymore, and I continued writing. I filed a lawsuit against them and in Washington, D.C., and a federal appeals court in Washington, D.C. agreed that I did have a valid cause and remanded it to the district court for prosecution. The Bureau of Prisons then came to me and said if I'd agree to dismiss the lawsuit against them, they would transfer me to any prison I wanted to go to for the rest of my time, which was about 18 months left at that time. And I did agree. All of this is in court documents. So it's what they literally did was use solitary confinement as their own personal punishment chamber to kind of coerce me into dismissing a lawsuit against them.
I'm surprised that you were paroled after so many prison breaks.
Well, actually, the parole board or the parole commission, they have what's called a notice of action that they send all inmates after you appear before them. And the notice of action tells you whether they're going to parole you, whether they're going to reduce your minimum time, or whether they're going to deny you parole at that time, or whatever it is that they're going to do. In my notice of action, after I went to the parole commission, after I began writing, this was several years later, they sent me a notice of action taking a year off of my guidelines, a year off of which I would normally have had to do, according to their calculations, for writing. They rewarded me for this. They specifically made reference to that. And on the other hand, as I said, the United States Bureau of Prisons, even at that time, had me in solitary confinement charged with a disciplinary infraction code 408, which is the code number for it, for doing it. So I had two government agencies, one condemning me and punishing me, and one rewarding me for doing the same thing.
Why did you give up trying to break out in 1980?
It's just, it got so old. You undergo burnout. Also, I was in my late 30s. There comes a point in life where, for all of us, whether we're inmates or non-inmates, where, we examine where we've been, where we are, and where we want to go. And, it usually occurs around age 40. And it was that way with me. And I was really doing some deep soul searching, deep thinking. And I didn't want to do this. I really did not want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a conversation with my mother at about that time too, where I promised her I was going to give it another shot, another way, and I did.
Your new novel, Stoneface, is about a character who is psychopathically brutal. I mean, he is just not fazed at all by brutality. Is he based on somebody who you knew in prison?
Practically all my characters, at least the male characters, are based on either on someone I knew in prison or compilations thereof of several people. There are a lot of characters in prison. I've had 30 years of character exposure. And yes, they're very real. They are not invented characters by any stretch of the imagination other than the name attributed to them and perhaps some of the actions. But by and large, these are the personalities that we're dealing with. People who would rather kill as a first option than a second.
I have to ask you, I think this is correct, that you wrote a screenplay that sold for six figures?
That's true.
Yeah. So now that you're dealing with, meetings in the publishing world and the movie world, do you find that there are aspects of having been something of a con man yourself that you can use in selling yourself now, which you have to do in publishing and in movies? You have to sell yourself, and you have to be able to talk a good line about whatever it is that you're writing.
Well, to begin with, I kind of like to clarify this title, this cup con man, so to speak. This was the FBI talking, not anybody else. The FBI was furious at me because of the incident over the jewels, mm-hmm. to speak, because of the fact that I did handcuff their agents and left them out in the woods and disabled one of their cars and drove away.
Right.
This is a very unsettling thing. It upset them a lot, obviously, and they were very, very outraged. So let's take it with a grain of salt when someone like the FBI accuses me of being a con man. I didn't start out being a con man. I have never been a con man per se. Everything that I've done has been pretty well up front. If anybody is really upset at me for escaping from what I consider literally an unjust system, then and they want to call me a con man by utilizing certain measures and doing that, that's fine.
Do you feel adjusted yet to life outside?
I'm still getting adjusted to it. No, I'm not totally adjusted. I walked out of solitary confinement. I didn't just walk out of prison. I walked out of a 5x8 cell that I had spent a year and a half in, and I'm talking about at San Diego at that time, after spending 2.5 years in Marion. So I had 4 years of solitary confinement when I walked out onto the streets at 6:15 in the morning, and it was still dark, and I was afraid to cross the street. And as it turned out, some people who were picking me up showed up a little late, arrived a little late. I had to wait about 5 minutes. And I think that was probably the most discombobulating 5 minutes of my life, because people passing by, you're literally outside. I'm wondering when someone's going to step out the shadows and grab me, this type of thing. And yeah, it was a great culture shock. And there's still a certain amount of culture shock. I went through a lot of changes when I first got out, and it's difficult. It's very difficult. It's hard to explain, but it's like you have to shed everything that you've experienced over the last 2 or 3 decades in order to survive. And you have to shed all of that, and you have to conform totally to society, to the society that you're in. and you have to handle things differently. You've got 911 now. You can't, you know, in prison, you don't have 911. You're expected to take care of bruised shins and other tragedies by yourself. So it's, and you deal with people, you know, even the little things like paying for my first meal, I almost didn't pay for it. I almost walked out without paying for it. Not because I was trying to stiff anybody, I just didn't think about it. Even for how many years have I been eating free food? I've had to pay for this stuff. Things like that. It takes an effort, and some getting over.
How do you think that you've been changed by the many years that you spent in prison? Is there any way of judging that?
How I've changed?
Yeah, how you were changed by it.
I don't think I was changed by it. Prison never changed me, not basically from who I was at first or who I am now. I'm still basically the same person who went into prison at 17 years of age. What it has done, it's educated me. It's because I do think that I observe things. I keep my eyes open. I like to look at things. I like to look at people. I like to know what's going on most of the time if I can. In prison, I learned what's going on.
After all your years in solitary, do you want to live alone now?
No. In fact, I don't live alone. I have a fiance, and we live together. We're going to be married in the very near future. In fact, we're working out the details now, or the timing. No, I don't want to be alone, but I do want, I am very choosy about who I am with, because of the simple fact that I just don't feel comfortable with everyone. And that's my problem. And it's a problem that I've been working on, and I probably will continue to work on.
I really wish we had more time to talk, but we've run out of time. I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Edward Jones' new crime novel, Stoneface, is published by Donald Fine. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.